Morning, you're listening to Galway Tux. If you want to get text and WhatsApp into us, you can do on our number at 086-3833-553. You can phone Eilish on reception on 091-770-077 and email comments at galwaybayfm.ie. Now, though, the Vintners Federation of Ireland says that urgent challenges facing the pub trade, including unsustainable labour costs and the escalating overall costs of doing business, is forcing many publicans to consider retirement in the next 2 years. The Federation is calling on the government to introduce key supports to ensure the sustainability of the hospitality sector. To discuss this further, I'm joined by Milltown publican Cathal Sheridan of Sheridan's Bar and Restaurant. Cathal, good morning. And it's been a difficult few weeks and months for the publican trade, particularly with price increases, so on and so forth. How are you finding it on the ground at the moment out in Milltown?
Morning, John, and thank you for having us on this morning, John. We're not too bad here in Milltown. I'm lucky, John, to be in a position where I have a successful bar and gastro business going here. But there are a lot of publicans around the country who are under pressure because of the perfect storm, I suppose, that's hitting our industry at the moment. Not just publicans, but small businesses all over Ireland. We've been hit by a tsunami of increases, and the cost of doing business is really affecting the trade out there at the moment. A lot of these things have been government led, and some have been led by increases in prices by our suppliers, etc., etc. But they're all going the one way. The price of everything is just going up, and we as publicans hate to be passing them on, but I'm afraid a lot of us, to stay viable and keep our margins, we have to pass them on. But there are things out there that the government can help us with, like all our utilities have gone through the roof, such as gas, DSB, water, rates. The VAT increase by the government last year from 9% to 13.5% has been detrimental to the food industry. The excise duty on alcohol is the second highest in Europe. And we could do with a reduction of the standard rate of VAT for all businesses back down to 21% from it was put up in 2008 to 23% as an emergency at the time of the crisis, but it's time to get it back down for all businesses to help us all to survive.
I know that warehouse tax deadline was recently as well. Has that been a big issue for the sector?
Not really, no. Anybody who has money in warehousing, that's their own personal thing, but that doesn't affect, I don't know anybody that's in that position. The government are saying that they're helping people to stay open by warehousing money, but what about the people that earn warehousing money? Like, we need them to get off the pot here now and help us now, not the people who have money warehoused. Like, that's a smokescreen by the government. And if they don't start listening to us up in Kildare Street, everyone in Kildare Street at the minute seems to be in election mode, but there'd be an awful lot of the industry gone by the time they wake up again and realise that they have to reduce some of these things. And it's in their hands. It's very simple. It's not like we're asking to reinvent the wheel. We're just asking for a little bit of reduction in VAT, both the hospitality rate and the 23%, and a reduction maybe in employers' PRSI and alcohol excise. It's if they continue with everything rising, the pub won't be a pub. And these pubs are more than just businesses. Like, they're the heart of many communities, and they offer a place of social interaction, celebration, tradition. And supporting them through these challenging times ahead is not just helping the pub owner, but it's also the cultural and social fabric of the countryside.
Yeah.
And it's not just pubs I'm talking about here. Small shops, hairdresser, etc. They're all being hit with all the same crisis at the moment. So we're just asking for them to get out of election mode and help the businesses of Ireland is what we're asking for. But they seem to fall asleep at the wheel as far as I'm concerned. And they're not listening. They're in European election mode, county councillor mode, and government mode to get re-elected. And by the time they get re-elected and get another government back in there, well, half the places will be out of business.
In terms of some of the increases there, you mentioned the VAT and all that. Minimum wage will hit €35 per hour on bank holidays within the next 18 months. Is that a big concern?
Well, what they've done with, and look, we know that the minimum wage has to be increased, but to increase it by the amount they've increased over a 16-month period is absolutely bananas. We have no problem getting to the living wage. All businesses know that there has to be a living wage, but trying to do it all in a 16-month period from and have it up and running by the 1st of January 2026, it's unsustainable. It will close business after business after business around the country. We have no problem doing it, but we're just asking the government to slow it down a small bit, delay and reevaluate. It's just too much too quickly.
You mentioned VAT, that's the big one, but excise and PRSI, do you believe they all need to be lowered?
Well, excise, we're the second highest rate of excise of alcohol in Europe. And I'm sure there'll be people coming on here afterwards saying, look, you can't bring down the excise because the shop owner, the super values, the Tesco's, etc., they'll get the same benefit as we get it. But you could bring it down on draft sales only, and it'll help the pub and not just the supermarkets. But it does have to be looked at, because there's a reason we're the second highest. It's the government, as I keep saying, the government tell us they have loads of money in the coffers. Well, why don't they help us by just changing these? We're not asking for 10% off excise or VAT. We're asking for small tweaks. Every small tweak will help us.
Mm. What is the pub trade like in Galway County at the moment? Have you noticed small rural pubs closing their doors?
Well, a lot of them have closed Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday now, and a lot of places are just open and gone off, gotten a job during the week, etc., etc., and they're only working at the weekends now. And that's probably the future of some of our pubs. But there are a lot of pubs, and don't get me wrong, doing thriving trades, but not as many as needs to be. We've a bit of benchmarking done there at the moment, and there's 37% of publicans are considering retirement in the next 2 years. That's a huge amount. And worse again, there's a figure there showing that 84% report that no family member wishes to inherit the family business. That's 84% of our sons and daughters are probably looking at us working 7 days a week or giving out about the business or giving out about whatever part of the business 7 days a week. Mm-hmm. And they don't want to get involved in the business because they just see it being opening 364 days a year. And there's an easier way of making a living now, they think.
Yeah, you mentioned the living wage as well, but with a lot of pubs going to weekend work only, it's now a part-time job for bar staff. Is it difficult to retain staff?
Yeah, well, I'm very lucky here now. I'm open from 10 o'clock in the morning until closing time and night time, but a lot of places do are finding it. But it's mainly, like, I employ 10 full-time staff, maybe 11, and 7 or 8 part-timers. And the 7 or 8 part-timers that I employ, they're delighted to be having the work at the weekends, and they're mainly students. So the people that are just open Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, it's mainly students that they are employing. So it's like all these small little businesses around rural Ireland, they keep so many people, they put so many people through college every year. And if the government don't help us now, they won't be there to give the students of Ireland the €250 that they earn at the weekends, or to go back to college and spend it in the community where they go to college. So we're asking the government to wake up quickly and not to be waiting until they're re-elected, etc., etc. Do it immediately. We need help now. Every small business in Ireland needs help at the moment.
I know the VFI is urging government to consider a number of specific measures. Let's go through them. The re-evaluation of the impending shift to a living wage in consideration of its impact on small businesses. Do you want them to postpone it, or what do you want to see done, Cathal?
Well, the government we know it's coming, but it's just too quick. It's just too fast for our industry to absorb. So we're asking them to delay, maybe just slow it down a small bit.
Yeah. In terms of the implementation of the different measures, reduction in the PRSI, excise duty, the VAT rate back to 9%, do you think you'll get commitments on all of those measures?
Well, we're asking for the manua, but it's falling on deaf ears at the moment.
Okay.
But we have to ask, because if you don't ask, we have to start shouting possibly, because if we don't shout, we won't get what we need. And if we don't get reduction in some of these things, businesses will close, and those students that I was talking about will not be having part-time jobs at the weekends.
Mm. Interesting, I see, as well as the hospitality VAT rate going back to that 9%, you want to see a reduction in the standard VAT rate from 23% to 21%. Will that help the business overall?
Oh, of course, and that'll help not just publicans, that'll help all businesses. You know, like that was introduced in 2008, I think, as an emergency to the financial crisis at the time. That's well and truly over, but we will soon have another financial crisis and businesses closing right, left and centre if we don't get some help.
Mm. Now, this other proposal, I quite like, a development of a transition scheme for new entrants and next generation publicans to encourage streamlined succession and ensure pubs remain viable in towns and villages. This is a very structured approach to keeping pubs, well, starting them for one, and keeping the ones that are there in business.
Yes, at the moment, that's just a new initiative we've taken on at head office in Dublin, and we're in negotiations with the government at the moment to try and help people who want to get out and have no one to follow them into it, to help them have a succession kind of a plan, get a succession plan going, or if people want to leave the industry, help them to get out of it without incurring extra costs. So that's all up being discussed at head office with the government at the moment. So that's one thing that we're hoping to get over the line. So.
And what would that actually look like? Is it just a plan, or is it a document, or what would it look like? What form would it take?
Well, it's not really, there's no meat on the bones yet. It's just kind of started off at the moment. So.
Very good. I know there's also a report conducted by the Drinks Industry Group of Ireland, which found that almost 2,000 pubs in Ireland have closed since 2005, with the group finding that rural businesses are most at risk of shutting their doors. That's a huge number since 2005.
Yeah, I'm afraid there's going to be more. We're according to the piece of work we've done there, with 37%, as I say, of publicans considering retirement in the next 2 years, and nobody in the family to take over. So I'm afraid that figure and that stat is going to get worse down the line. But it's easy to see, like, the majority, and everyone in Ireland realised that the majority of alcohol anymore has been sold by the multiples. It's not the pubs of Ireland that are selling it. I think we sell 30% or around. The hospitality industry sells 30-something percent of alcohol. And the other 68 or 67% has been sold by the Tesco's, the Super Values, etc., etc. So our industry is changed completely. And since 2005, there's been a huge change. That's 19 years. There's been a monster change in our industry over those 19 years.
You know, you mentioned there that as we look towards the upcoming elections, that there's a lot of murmurs and a lot of kite flying. Is waiting until the budget in the fall too late?
Absolutely. Oh, way too late. Like, you hear Adrian Cummins there, he's the head of the Restaurant Association there. He's shouting every day or every week about 8 restaurants being closed this week, 10 last week, 12 the week going on. They're closing to a penny, and there's nothing. The reason they're closing is because the cost of doing business has just, as I say, a tsunami hit the industry in the last year, and the cost of doing business has just gone through the roof, and it's not sustainable to keep it as it is. So all small businesses are finding it hard at the moment.
All right, Cathal Sheridan, the owner of Sheridan's Bar and Restaurant in Milltown, thank you for joining us on Goa Talks.
Thank you very much, John.
Now, what are your thoughts on that subject? Get them into us on 086-3833-553. You can phone Eilish on reception on 091-77-0077 and email comments at goabfm.ie. Some of the comments coming in this morning. John, I'm sick of listening to the bail bucks from pub and restaurant owners. If it's so hard to navigate all the new rules, why do you stay in it? Of course, you make money. Staff need a living wage either way. I think the point is a lot of them are closing their doors. And another listener says that I popped into a pub in Galway last Friday, and an older landlady opens 4 nights a week and the rates will kill her business. She received no notification on the increases, which went from 900 a year to 6,000 plus. Trade in rural areas are already reduced because people have no way to get to the local pub, not only closing business, but causing more isolation in rural areas. It's very sad, and something needs to change to support rural areas and businesses. And if you want to get your comment into us, do straight away. Now, though, we're coming back and we're speaking to Pat Griffin, who is a senior inspector with the Health and Safety Authority, about their National Farm Safety Inspection Campaign, which is now underway. Good morning.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Visit Windsor Motor Mall Galway on the Monavay Road, a new way to car shop.
You're listening to Galway Talks with John Morley. Now, the HSA, the Health and Safety Authority, has launched a national farm safety campaign and are in the process of inspecting farms nationwide to focus on the safe use of tractors and other machinery and vehicles on the farm. To discuss this further, I'm joined on the line now by Pat Griffin, who is a senior inspector with the Health and Safety Authority. Pat, good morning. And this farm safety campaign is well and truly underway as the farming season kicks up a few gears.
Yeah, it's a very busy time, and sadly, in previous years, we've seen a spike in farm fatalities, particularly during July, and that's generally associated with activity around silage season, and it has started already. We're seeing the tractors and trailers running on the roads, and we want to come out and try to help farmers and contractors stay safe this silage season.
Talk to us about the work you'll be doing in these inspections.
Yeah, well, sadly, over the last 10 years, we've had 191 fatalities, and 96 of these involved tractors and machinery. And a lot of the fatalities, in fact, were older people and young people actually in the yard or associated with the work. So we're coming out, running this campaign to raise awareness of the risks and ask farmers and contractors to plan for safety, to do a bit of planning, do a bit of preparation to make sure that they can have a safe silage season and none of them have to go to a family member or anyone to tell them of a life-changing injury or fatality. Really, when we talk about silage season, the farmer or contractor has to think about three major things: the operators, the machinery they're using, and then the system of work. And if you get all these things right, they can have a safe silage season. Our inspectors will be out. They'll be going to farms where the activity is on, and they'll be trying to help farmers and give them advice and tell them of the resources that they can use actually to plan for safety this silage season.
And I know that the majority of the cause of fatalities has been farm machinery and the vehicles on the farmyard.
Yeah, vehicles. You know, the figures are quite stark. With 96 fatalities over the last 10 years, 44 of them directly involved tractors, 10 with teleporters and loaders, and then 10 with quad bikes. And, you know, if farmers really consider the safety around tractors and make sure that the operators are competent, that the tractor is properly made, maintained, and that the operators are fit for work, I think we can actually reduce some of these fatalities. One of the big concerns is the standard of some of the tractors that are being used, whether the brakes are tested, that the steering is good, and that the linkage between the tractor and trailer is actually properly linked through. So we'd ask farmers to do a lot of preparatory work prior to getting out there and make sure that the machinery is properly maintained.
I know the majority of the injuries and fatalities involved a combination of operator errors and poor maintenance, a lack of training, with also the issue of children and elderly people working near the activity. What do farmers need to consider?
What they really need to think about is when this silage season is on, it's no place for children, it's no place for elderly people in the yard. And we'd ask farmers to try to make the yard and the pit a no-go area. These machines are very, very, very big these days, and operators that are trying to fill the pit, roll the pit, and do the job, they don't have a whole lot of time to be looking around. So we really want people to make the yard a no-go area when there's at busy times. These machines are that big, there's an awful lot of blind spots from these machines. And in fact, as the tractor moves or trailer moves, the blind spot changes all the time. So really, we have to make it a no-go area and try to keep people out. The sad fact is, last few years, a few people in the yard itself, working around the yard, maybe tidying up at the edges, some of them have been hit and very, very seriously injured. So anyone that has to work on the ground around the pit should be wearing a high-vis vest, and they should make sure that the operator is coming in and out and the person rolling the pit actually knows they're there and can see them.
Is fatigue a problem for farmers? I know a lot of them work long hours, particularly during the silage season.
Absolutely, fatigue is a problem, and we all know that farmers have to take that window of opportunity when the weather is good, and a lot of them will work very, very long hours. But if you work extended hours, over 12 hours in the day, you're actually doubling the risk of an incident. And if you work for two or three nights, very, very long hours, maybe 14, 15 hours, you are really at high risk of having an incident. We have brought out a new guidance document called Managing Fatigue in Farming, and our inspectors will be handing out that guidance when they are on inspection, and that guidance is freely available on our website. It's just recently published. We only published it there in the last number of weeks, and it points to how you can actually manage fatigue and make sure that people don't have these dreadful incidents.
Mm. I know you also have a risk assessment on that website.
Yeah, we actually updated the risk assessment documents there about 4 years ago to include a risk assessment on harvest time, which brings the farmer or the contractor through a series of questions that will remind them of the things they need to get right. And I think if that risk assessment is used, and the risk assessments around tractors and machinery are also used from the code of practice, you know, you can actually identify a lot of the things that you have to keep right, and maybe, you know, we'll have a safe silage season.
Is there also an onus on other road users? Because I know with farm machinery being on the roads, it can cause delays for other traffic if they can't overtake. But people just need to make that extra bit of time during this time so they don't make unnecessary risks on the road.
Yeah, I mean, everyone has a responsibility on the road. Contractors and farmers using the roads for silage season, they have to have consideration for other road users. Controlling speed, making sure that you know, that all the operators that are working for you follow the rules, reduce their speed, stay off the mobile phone, and take care about who could be around that bend. We all are entitled to use the public roads, and obviously if you are in an area where there's silage being cut, you have to be aware of that and keep safe. But, you know, we all have to practice safety on the roads when we're out there.
Pat Griffin, the Senior Inspector with the Health and Safety Authority. If people want to get more information on this, where's the best place of getting that?
Yeah, just drop into the HSA website, hsa.ie, and look at the agricultural pages. All the guidance is there, all the risk assessments are there, and the new guidance on fatigue is also there.
All right, Pat Griffin, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thank you very much, John.
And we'll be talking about Eurovision next.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Drive happy in Windsor Motor Mall, Galway, with hundreds of used cars to suit your budget.
You listen to Galway Talks with John Morley, and we're looking at the Eurovision now, because it was all happening over the weekend, over the past few days, with the news that Nemo won the Eurovision, the Swiss entry, with the song, I must say, is very catchy, The Code. And to get their thoughts on this, we're joined again by our Eurovision panel, Mark Roberts, our very own Mark Roberts, who came second in 1997, and also Niall Mooney of one of the juries here in Ireland. You're both very welcome onto the programme. And Mark, I'll start with you. The Code, did you enjoy the song, and was it a worthy winner?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I had tipped it to win, believe it or not. I said this on my program, Breakfast Show, over the weekend. I actually picked the top three, and I actually picked where Ireland was going to. It's the first year in a long time that I actually listened to all of the contenders, and I had the correct top three. I loved France. I can't believe they came fourth, but I thought the French song was gorgeous. Yeah. But yeah, worthy winner, I think.
Definitely. We're also joined on the line by Niall Mooney. Niall, what was your reaction to the result of the weekend?
Yeah, I thought it was a good result. Celine Dion won it for Switzerland before. I think it's a worthy successor. I thought his performance was outstanding. Actually, maybe the performances were bigger than some of the songs this year, and I think people went for performance, including Ireland. So I think they had a fantastic performance. Maybe not my favourite song of the night, but definitely one of the best performances for sure, yeah.
It was very interesting. And Mark, I know that there's a lot of talk about, and it's always been a feature of the Eurovision, that they give a lot of representation to LGBT artists, and Nemo themselves is non-binary, and including other artists like Bambi Thug as well. So it was really a year for the non-binary artists at the Eurovision.
Well, they always talk about inclusivity and united by music, and that's exactly what the premise of the show is. So it's good in that sense, absolutely. And at the end of the day, they're just fantastic songs. I know a lot of people will say, are they though? And as Niall said, a lot is down to performance nowadays, because you do have the choice. I remember a couple of years ago, one of our artists, I forget her name, totally escapes me, but they put her in a little box and she was like in the corner of a stage performing to the camera. But as a result, there was about 10 20,000 people in the arena that just didn't know what was going on. So it's that balancing act of trying to keep the audience at home interested and trying to keep the people in the arena. But it was very much big performances, you know.
Mm. What did you make, Mark, of the disqualification of the Netherlands?
Yeah, I never listened to hearsay. There's an awful lot of different stories going around on social media, which is what social media is all about. So all you can do is trust the process in the sense of, I mean, I remember in my year, Bambi Thug mentioned this in after Eurovision as well. There's so much that goes on, and I think that's why we as people who have performed in Eurovision are quite close. I was talking to the birthday boy this morning, Johnny Logan. Today is his 70th, so he's chilling out for the day. But I mean, we have that connection, and that nobody knows what goes on, but an awful lot of crap happens behind the scenes and an awful lot of pressure. I remember in my year on the Wednesday, I got a call from one of the tabloids, and they said, Mark, you all said everything's great, you know, you're looking forward to it. And I was like, yeah. And they said, what about the bomb? And I said, what? What bomb? What are you on about? And they said, oh, you haven't heard, but there's been a coded message sent to the from the IRA that at 20 minutes past 8, which is the time you're on stage, a bomb will go off in the Point Theatre in Dublin. How do you feel? I said, well, there's not a whole pile. I have to trust the process in the sense of, they said, yeah, but hang on a second. There's going to be sniffer dogs. There's going to be extra security. How do you think that's going to make us look? And all you could say at the end of the day is, as I said, trust the process. These people know what they're doing. It's security. We were actually turfed out of the Point Theatre twice so that they could actually go in with the sniffer dogs to make sure everything was fine. But I just had to say, you know, you have to, there are things in place. And if you step out of line or if something happens, something else kicks in.
So. Mm. And Niall, to you, what do you make of the EBU has come under awful fire by contestants and participant countries alike following the disqualification of the Netherlands? What do you make of that unfolding saga over the weekend?
Well, when it came to the Netherlands, I know there was a lot of jostling going on in advance. I think what he ended up getting suspended for was an allegation made by a Eurovision female photographer or crew member. So I don't know whether it was tied into, it might have been triggered by, you know, a lot of the kind of anxiousness that was going on. My feeling about it is the EBU are the organizers, and I've been over to the Eurovision on multiple occasions, and it can be very, very stressful. And if you add stress, like some of the stress that was being added this year, I'm sure it only compounds it. But look, they're the host, and you have to kind of, you know, allow them be in charge. You know what I mean? You can't take over the situation for your own gain. And I think that I'd say it was a very, very reluctant decision. I cannot imagine, you know, Netherlands are like one of the biggest contributors to the Eurovision. So I imagine they did not want to do that. That's my guess. My guess is there's no way they wanted to do that. So I don't know why they found whatever the final trigger was, which I don't really know what it was. You can be damn sure they didn't want to do that. I would say that much for sure. From my own experience, they don't want to kick people out ever. You know, so I feel sorry for your man. I don't know what happened, but it didn't help the contest that he was kicked out. It would have been just better. I mean, he did a kind of a thank you to his parents. You know, at the end of a song, he could have had a very, very good final if he had, you know, held it together. You know what I mean?
Mm. And poor old Martin Osterdahl, the EBU's executive supervisor for the Eurovision, he was booed during all of his announcements as well.
Yeah. And I don't think that was fair. I mean, he was juggling a lot of issues and not of his own making. I mean, you can't do much about the international situation. And, you know, every decision you make is going to upset someone else. I personally found that was a low point of the night. Mm. For me, that was, I would have felt very, I've met him a couple of times and I would have felt pretty bad for him because I know he's a very likable fella and I know he's trying to do the best thing, you know, that's my opinion.
Mm. And Israel, a lot of talk about Israel over the weekend, but they did very well, particularly with the public vote, Niall, and from ourselves here in Ireland.
Mm. Well, look, they didn't do well with the juries, right? So I've heard people say, oh, well, maybe, you know, there was a kind of a voting pact that, like, conspiracies going on. I said, well, look, you could say it the other way around. The juries didn't vote for them. The public televote was very good for them. But for example, if you came second in a televote in Ireland, that would probably equate to somewhere between, Mark would probably confirm this, about somewhere between anywhere from 12 to 23% of the vote. So it's not like, you know, they ran away with it. But, you know, that's, you know, with 25 songs, 15, 20%. We spoke about this last week about Bambi. Bambi only needed to appeal to, you know, 10 or 15% of the public vote to get into the semifinals, you know, and she came third, which was fantastic. But that, again, would only equate to maybe 15% or something, you know?
Yeah.
So it's, you know, I don't think it should be overly analyzed, you know, that's just the way it is. People's tensions were high and people probably were a little bit motivated by some people maybe genuinely feeling sorry for her, some people loving the song. I personally like the Israeli song. I'm not going to say I don't. I thought it was a great song. And some people may be motivated for political reasons, but it was also political reasons to vote against her as well, I think. So,
Mark, what do you make of that? Israel did quite well, but some people have made the argument that a lot of people who boycotted the Eurovision would have voted opposite to Israel, so maybe they shot themselves in the foot in terms of that.
Well, there could be a lot of that, and there's always going to be a lot of speculation in that sense. But I see on social media, what a lot of them are sussing out is things like 2 years in a row, the jury winner wins the Eurovision, even though the televote score with the tele winner was huge. So it's kind of, they're questioning now whether juries should be there. Should it be just totally a public vote? And this, I mean, it gets more confusing every year, to be quite honest. I mean, I can't begin to imagine. I know what it's like to be sitting in the green room watching and waiting when you know the next country is coming on and what did we get? Will we get anything? But this crack of when you sit and you go through juries and then all of a sudden there's the public vote and everything turns totally on its head. It's do you know what I mean? I have no idea what's going to happen. Maybe Niall has any ideas, but as to how it's going to evolve, I mean, this year the world was voting. I don't know. It's mad.
I felt bad for poor old Ollie Alexander, formerly years and years, and getting 0 points from the public.
Yeah, that's unheard of. It's mad. I mean, you can't question the man's ability, his talent. He's like, I mean, how many different aspects of the arts is he involved? He's an accomplished writer, performer, singer, actor, you know, all award winning. And then this happens. Whether it's some kind of a backlash or something, I really don't know. But it just did not make sense. The song was not that bad.
Now, what about you? The UK getting 0 points in the public. Poor Ollie Alexander licking wounds.
Well, look, I'll be straight up. I didn't like Ollie's song. I think he's a competent performer, but the song, when I heard it first, I was convinced it was an off-cut from an Erasure album from the 80s. I thought it was so dated that even it would make me look young, you know? So I wasn't into it. I would just say on the thing about the boycott, though, is that as far as I heard, the early reports is that the viewership, despite all the controversies in Ireland, I think was up quite a bit for RTE. So they'll be quite happy that, you know, probably Bambi brought that audience, to be fair to her. But I think Ollie, honestly, the English were not at the races this year. Performatively, again, they were up there with some of the other acts, but I thought the song was just sounded like Erasure, Pet Shop Boys, without anything new to it. That's what I thought.
And Niall, it's all roads leading to Switzerland now, and I believe Geneva, sixth place finish for Ireland this year. Can we build on that for next year?
I think if RTE take the lessons that probably Bambi actually gave to RTE, which is about, you know, I would say a lot of the staging that Ireland did was motivated by Bambi and her team. You know, it was such, Mark was talking about some of the staging we've done in the past where it was dreadful. This, you know, if we could take from that, I would say, you know, we could start doing better and better each year. I'm hoping this is the start of a renaissance for Ireland.
Yeah, Mark, are you similarly positive?
Absolutely. And I think the interest is there all over again from the public. It's just like having come sixth now that there's a renewed interest. And I mean, I agree with Niall totally. I think Bambi Thug, they did a fantastic job, but they also were 100% involved in every aspect of the song, the writing, the performance, the makeup. It was like a theatrical, artistic installation for the Eurovision. It was so different, but it was well thought out and well... And I know a lot of people were frightened by it, but at the same time, I mean, that's what Eurovision's about. It's grabbing attention, you know.
Mm. Definitely. It's interesting. We'll be looking at it next year as well. And some people won't, and that's their right as well. But Mark Roberts, former runner-up in the Eurovision in 1997, and Niall Mooney of one of the juries here in Ireland. Thank you both for joining us on Galway Talks. Just some of the comments coming into us in that vein this morning. If you want to get them into us, you can do our text or WhatsApp number. That's 086-3833-553. John, the Eurovision was not a song contest. The English one was gross and Ireland's was like an evil movie. France should have won, says this listener. Someone else says, the Eurovision has become a freak show and the English song was so suggestive and it was insulting. It's no longer about the music. It's pushing an agenda. I will never watch it again. I watched for 50 years and look forward to it, but never again. That comes in from Deirdre. And morning, John. I must have been watching a different Eurovision than your guests. What I saw and heard was absolutely the greatest load of sugar. And call it what it is, John, dreadful. So there's plenty more comments coming in that vein about the Eurovision, but we're all talking about it this morning, so maybe they're happy out. Another listener says that they think the Eurovision was a disgrace and that it was the devil's work. So they are some of the calls coming in this morning. Now, though, I want to change tact altogether because I'm joined on the line by Mary Connaughton of CIPD because there's a warning over rising worker mental health concerns. A HR survey shows issues now blamed for absenteeism as often as acute medical conditions. Mary, good morning. There's some stark findings in this survey.
Good morning, John. Yes, indeed. Our HR practices survey this year was asking about absenteeism and causes of absenteeism. And I think for the first time, we're seeing that people are out of work for mental health purposes as much as they are out from acute medical conditions, which is worrying in terms of trying to address this particular issue and make sure the right supports are in place for our individuals.
Mm. Talk us through some of the big findings. I know workload is a big contributing factor to all this.
Yes, certainly people are saying that work volume is one of the issues that people are experiencing. Now, also non-work factors are as well. So most commonly, like non-work factors are contributing relationships, family, finances. But workload, when it comes to the workplace, it's around workload and lack of management support. And then the other thing is around the technology, the always on culture, that technology causes. So that's seen as being a contributing factor. And then just trying to cope with change. Mm. A lot of jobs are changing and structures are changing for people when they're at work. And that's another worrisome factor.
Yeah, another disparity is between the public sector and the private sector in terms of financial stress.
Yes, yes. More financial stress from public sector respondents than from private sector respondents, which is sort of interesting to note because it's not something we had tracked before. And then we also saw more worry around returning to the office as an issue in the public sector compared to the private sector. So it seems to have stabilized, the approach to it seems to have stabilized a bit more in the private sector than it does in the public sector. Mm. But certainly in our discussions now with our members, like the HR community, we're talking about the need to invest more in supports for managers to enable them to have the right conversations and know how to support people better in the workplace. Mm. Now, we are seeing good supports around well-being. So there are well-being initiatives happening in lots of organisations, which are good to see. But I think sometimes they may not be the right ones or they may not be having the impact. So we think people need to step back and say, well, is this actually benefiting employees? Is this the right thing to be doing? And maybe have another look at what they're doing under, the well-being umbrella.
Mm. Concern for employers in terms of this ongoing skills shortage.
Yes. So, I mean, we know that unemployment is low. So we have, in essence, a full labour market here, which is great, which is good news. It means that there is access to work for people and jobs available out there. But we are seeing that employers are suffering skill shortages. And that's like over 90% of them said there was some kind of skill that they haven't been able to get over the last year. And for many, that just boils down to sort of operational frontline roles. roles that they need to have more people available for. But then we asked another question in terms of like, what are the things that are impacting you most in terms of not necessarily the jobs, but in terms of what people are able to do? And two interesting ones comes through on that. One is around leadership and influencing. So how good people are at sort of providing some kind of leadership. And that doesn't necessarily just mean in a senior role job, but just in their role to be able to sort of influence others in a positive way. And then the second one was a sort of the technical area around IT, around programming, around bringing in AI, that sort of development. So we know a lot of organizations are trying to grow the agenda and draw on technology and AI more, but still they're struggling to find the right skill set in it.
Yeah, I know that IT, for example, that's a job that can be done remotely. So perhaps they're being snapped up by international markets.
Well, certainly our findings would say that organisations know that not just in IT, but generally having access to flexible working is important. So it's a key thing in trying to attract people in. So there is, we're seeing that is growing. So it's not so much that this year we saw that more companies were offering flexible working, but the companies were trying to find flexible working for people who maybe traditionally didn't have access to it. So kind of being a bit more creative in terms of who in the workforce might be able to get some level of flexible working. So yes, certainly we are seeing that access to hybrid working and flexible working is important. And it also gives people a chance to maybe not work in a large city or urban area. So they have more choice about where they live, and that's a cost reducing factor. So cost and housing all play into these decisions, much more so nowadays than they used to.
Interesting, I think that 36% of respondents identified leadership and influencing skills as their top capability gap, because that's an important part of steering your business.
It is. It's a very important part. And I think what can happen now too is like businesses and organizations are just changing dramatically with technology, with ways of working. And, you know, sometimes organizations have traditional leaders in place, and it's about moving that forward. So leaders and managers are better able to cope with sort of growing employee expectations and people working in different ways and issues like mental health and need for upskilling, and it just needs a different approach. So we're seeing some organisations invest in leadership development, but we do see that at a national level, there needs to be more investment in it. And I'm sure many of your listeners will identify, you know, that sometimes the leadership style or approach may not be listening enough or engaging enough for employees. So sort of some development is definitely needed in that space.
So Mary Connaughton of CIPD, if people want to look at this survey in better detail, where's the best place of looking at it?
Well, it's on our website, so it's on CIPD, the CIPD website, so people will find it there if they just Google that. And then if you look up sort of, it's our HR practices survey 2024, so they should be able to find that without any difficulty. And it's all done in infographics as well, so it's not too heavy a read.
Good. Mary Connaughton of CIPD, thank you for joining us on Galway Talks.
Thanks, John. Bye.
Now, just looking at our winner and qualifier for today. Today's qualifier for our golf prize, which is a one-night midweek stay for two people at the Connacht Hotel with a round of golf and lunch at the Galway Bay Golf Resort. Thanks to the team at Galway Bay Golf Resort in Oranmore and the Connacht Hospitality Group is Mike Graney. Congratulations, Mike. You're in the daily qualifier, and we'll be announcing the competition every day on our sports bulletin at 10 o'clock. So stay tuned tomorrow at 10 and throughout the week at 10 o'clock to be in with a chance of hearing that question, entering, and then daily qualifying as well. And we'll be announcing the overall winner of that prize at the end of the week on our sports bulletin. Still to come on the programme today, though, we have Galway Greats, because I went out to Ballinasloe last week and met an interesting gentleman, Sean Keely. He's part of that 1956 Galway Football All-Ireland winning team. And I spoke to him about his footballing career and his life in general. And we had a bit of crack as well, because he's great fun. So tune into that from 10 past 11. We also have our sports preview, our review even, following a busy weekend in sports. All that and a lot more topics coming up between now and 12 o'clock on Galway Talks. Good morning.
Galway Talks in association with Windsor Motor Mall. Visit Windsor Motor Mall Galway and get free 3-year warranty on hundreds of used cars.